This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Nicole Helgett. She's the author of a novel called The Turtle Catcher, which is a novel. I guess I just said that. But it's a book that I find astonishingly beautiful, and I really wanted to talk to Nicole about it. How are you, Nicole?
I'm real well. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's really a great pleasure to talk to you. I read a lot of books, and I read a lot of really good books. This book just knocked me out.
I'm so pleased. Thank you.
Well, I do have a partiality to books that are set in Minnesota because I have these family connections there, but that's kind of what caught my eye about the book in the first place. But just because you're from Minnesota doesn't mean you're going to be a really great writer.
Right.
So I was happily surprised. The title of the book, The Turtle Catcher, refers to this character who, and of course the scene that opens the book, which I think, what I've read is that the book started as a short story.
Right.
I assume is the beginning of the novel.
Right.
And there's this, I don't want to give away too much to people who haven't read it, but it's a pretty powerful opening where these brothers in Minnesota about, I think it's 1918, right after the close of World War I, are forcing this neighbor who's a kind of mentally incapacitated guy to drown, basically, in the pond, the lake that they live near. And it's just an amazingly beautiful scene, even though it's very painful.
Yeah.
And I guess, the first question, before I ask any questions, that sets the scene for the book, but then you jump back so that we begin to understand how the characters got to that terrible scene.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the book takes place it's a fictional town, I presume?
Sort of. It's based on a town I live near and that I lived in for some time called New Ulm, Minnesota, who actually experienced a lot of the wartime problems that I chronicle in the book.
Right, which is that the town is made up primarily of German immigrants to America who came prior to World War I, obviously, and
right.
They came to Minnesota when it was probably late 19th century, more or less wilderness to be, farmed by immigrants from Germany, Scandinavia, as my great-grandparents came from Lithuania. It's a lot of the northern climate countries of Europe ended up in the northern climate state of Minnesota.
Yep.
And from what struck me throughout, aside from the kind of mannered Germanness of the people who lived in this town as you portray them, is how harsh the environment was, both physically and emotionally, psychologically.
Yeah.
Things happen in this novel that I think we can believe must have happened in that period of time. Obviously, some of this you've made up. But it's you get this feeling of the difficulty that people had both expressing their emotions and just terrible things happen. The guy who ends up being drowned by the brothers, it's unclear, but it seems that he might have become incapacitated by being beaten by his father.
Yeah, yep, that was my intention. And the other people with their sort of communication problems are all just based on my experience with the people in my family and the people around here. I think a lot of us here have carried that sort of quiet stoicism into this generation where we're still conditioned to kind of keep quiet and not talk about family problems.
Right.
So it was really easy for me to translate that sort of mood into these characters.
Yeah, I sort of, you know, I think I remember from when I did spend some time in Minnesota, I was really impressed with Carol Bly, who I, you know, grew up in, actually, I think southwestern Minnesota, not probably that far from where you did.
Right, I think they're around the Marshall area, right?
I think it was Marshall.
Yeah.
And, you know, I also have a really close friend who's a writer named Maureen Owen who grew up out there as well. And but particularly Carol talking about the lives of women on these farms, isolated in the winters, you know, with lots of drinking going on, you know, tremendous inability for people to share their emotions and talk about the things that were happening to them. And it was partially, you know, that's what they came over with. It's not like that's what they learned there. It was part of their culture when they came.
Right, absolutely.
But, you know, it carried forward well into the present time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that was one of her, I think, life's work was to try to help women on the prairies basically overcome these terrible situations. You know,
right.
And I think what you portray in the book is, you know, and I know having read a little bit about it, you know, that people feel that it's really dark, and I think it is, you know, it is a dark novel. It's hard to not feel that way. But, you know, I never felt anything other than your, you know, my compassion being prompted by your kind of ability to relate to these people. I felt like, you know, there wasn't a judgment going on and portraying them as dark as some way of condemning them. It's
okay.
Much more about trying to figure out who they are and how they got here.
Mm-hmm.
When I
first started writing and my work was being called gloomy and dark, I was sort of offended by it, and I wasn't aware of this phenomenon in my writing because I really thought that this was just how everybody thought and everybody lived. I felt like it was real. Since then, I've realized that not everybody is quite so gloomy about the state of relationships and the state of politics and, you know, whatever else. And so I'm okay now with some readers not being able to read my work or calling it gloomy and dark. I have come to embrace those qualities instead of reject them.
Well, maybe, I mean, there is a certain amount of gloominess, I guess, in the, you know, sort of psyche of, you know, of certain cultures. But I think it was, I felt more like it was pain rather than gloominess.
Oh. I'm so glad you say that because even more than love, I think that the emotion that connects all of us on the planet is pain. We've all experienced pain.
Right, and that is what makes people hopefully sympathetic to one another.
Right.
You understand the other person's pain.
Right.
Now, of course, you know, even as they, you know, at the beginning, as they kill Lester, I think, you know, they do feel this incredible sense of, I wouldn't even call it guilt. It's more like terror of themselves, which they have to bury.
Right.
But it was so interesting also, you know, you have Lester as, you know, what he is great at doing is catching snapping turtles.
Yeah.
That's what connects him to the woman, Liesl. You know, we haven't really talked about it, and I think it's probably, there's a lot of complicatedness in the story. In other words, there are a lot of characters and a lot of people to keep track of, and probably not necessary for us to try to track them all here as we're talking, but you know, you have the various families in this town, and and you trace them back to where they came from and how they got there and what their secrets are, which are buried, you know, continually. I think that's a theme throughout the book, is these secrets that are buried. They're either buried within the psyche of the person, or they're buried within the lake, you know, and that, I think, is really the kind of magicalness of these people, and that they're, you kind of bring it forward into the past to how those secrets become part of the lives of their descendants.
I'm glad that that came through as well. I believe that the secrets of the past, not even so much like the sins of the past as the saying goes, but the secrets of the past will manifest in whatever generation hasn't had to deal with them yet. It will somehow come to the forefront at some point. And so that's what I was sort of messing with thematically. I'm glad to hear somebody got it or gets it.
Well, I'm sure people do. I think, you know, maybe they just don't tell you.
but
I think there's the reason I wanted to talk about the turtle and I kind of distracted myself was here you have Lester, who really is incredibly adept at killing turtles. He catches the turtles and then brings them to Liesl, who's the girl who is in the family in the farm next door that he's just in love with in his own way.
Mm-hmm.
And they eat the turtles. You know, that's kind mm-hmm. of what, you know, poor people did on a farm.
Mm-hmm.
You'd eat what was available to you.
Right.
But,
mm-hmm.
of course, then you have him as in this kind of, and I think this is the part that I is kind of the transformativeness, is the thing that he is most adept at killing is what spiritually he becomes.
Right, yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
he lives under, the, in a kind of magical way, then he becomes the inhabitant of the dark recesses, whether it's, you know, literally or figuratively, he's under the surface.
Right, I don't know that I was thinking of it so eloquently when I was writing it, and these things, readers sometimes identify them as symbols, sometimes only become apparent to me afterward. Like when I'm writing, it's just about making details pay off. Like I don't want to spend a lot of time writing about things that don't come back for the reader to enjoy or to make connections. But I always enjoy hearing readers' perspectives on what's going on in the book, and they're a lot of times much more eloquently phrased than I could have ever phrased them.
Well, that's, you know, I think that's maybe part of the magic of writing, that, you know, I don't think that it's possible. You know, critics see books differently, I think, than writers do. And I tend to fall more into the camp of the writer. The magic of fiction and of literature is that it's not by design that things become transformative and beautiful and kind of deeply connective to readers. I think that's the magic. You know, it's the sympathetic relationship between the art and the artist. And, you know, it isn't that you sit down and plan out, you know, everything you're going to do. I mean, there may be writers who do that, but I think most writers, that's where, you know, you tap into this kind of well of creativity that's the underlying kind of part of what human beings are about.
Oh, right. That is how it is. I heard or I read Junot Diaz, who wrote The Wondrous Life of Oscar, call writing like riding a wild horse. And I just thought, oh, that's exactly what it's like. I wish I had thought of that.
And of course the image that I've always stuck with is the Orpheus story. You know, the great movie Orphée, Jean Cocteau, has the poet tuning in a radio in an abandoned car, and he's writing down the messages that he hears on the radio, which are essentially the poems coming to him from outer space.
Oh,
and, you know, whether it's from outer space or inner space, I think the idea is the same, that, you know, you're writing what you, in a state that is other than daily life. And, you know, I think that comes through in your book, you know. And it was funny because I felt like when I was reading it, you know, there are these magical things that happen. And then, of course, I thought to myself, magical realism, that's what this is. And, you know, because you were, it was very naturally part of the story. And, of course, you're not used to, you know, that kind of, the idea of magical realism comes from, you know, maybe Latin American writers, which are completely, you know, couldn't be farther away from your story than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're you're in the cold part.
I've heard that before from readers, and I have to say that I don't mind people calling it supernatural. I'm actually A-okay with that, and that's what I refer to it myself as. But I discovered that I could make this move, you know, make Lester become like a turtle creature from Thomas Mann, who wrote this book. I think it was called The Holy Sinner, and I read it ages and ages and ages ago, but I just remember one of his characters was thrown out into the desert and turned into a creature, and I was just amazed, and I thought, wow, I can do that, and so I basically ripped it off from him. But I read Latin American literature, and I enjoy Marquez and Allende, and magical realism is fine with me as well.
Well, so, you know, do you consider yourself in that way? I mean, do you sort of identify yourself as a Minnesota writer? Is that an important part of your identity, this kind of, you know, the importance of where you grew up and the people that you grew up with and the place that you live in? Is that part of your self-identification as a writer?
It is. I'm just filling out grant applications for the Minnesota State Arts Board, and I was just writing about this today and thinking about the artist's place in Minnesota and where the inspiration comes from, and so much of it is from the setting here, the harsh winters and really hot summers. And, you know, in my own family, we were talking before about how hard the winters can be on a person's psyche, and just, you know, remembering my mother trying to make it through the winters out on the farm and my dad being gone, and she's sitting there with six kids and it's really lonely. And you just can't complain to anyone. It's not what we do. And I think that's where art comes in Minnesota. We need these artistic outlets. We need books. We need museums. We need paintings to keep us sane during these long, long cold and wet spells.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. But the extremeness of the terrain, you know, and of course Minnesota is not alone in having harsh, difficult winters. You know, I think about the prairies, you know, maybe out in, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, where it's, you know, they're more ranchers than farmers. But of course even fewer people in those places, and at least in Minnesota there are, you know, bigger towns and you know, aggregations of people who can kind of get together in some way, probably, you know, more so than some of the more isolated places too.
I see it go, gosh, this might be insulting, but I don't mean it to be. I see it go in one of two ways. Some communities will turn toward religion and they'll get really euphoric about their religious practices, and some communities or states like Minnesota really embrace their artistic talents, and they celebrate them and build museums and things like that. So I'm happy to be here.
Well, and it's true. Minnesota has produced a lot of great writers, I think. You know, it's maybe more than its fair share. Or maybe it attracts, you know, maybe partially too, because, you know, you look at the Twin Cities as being the biggest city in the cities in the upper Midwest, you know, and they kind of attract, you know, anyone who might be interested in art and literature. You know, they may end up in a, you know, in Minneapolis or St. Paul, as opposed to staying in their small town somewhere.
So now,
where you live in Mankato?
That's right, yep.
And is that roughly near where you grew up?
It's about 45 minutes away, yep. So I've been in this area all my life.
And your family's still around there?
Nearly everyone. I have four sisters living in this very town. My mom still lives on the home farm with my littlest sister. And my dad is in Red Wing, Minnesota.
Oh, yeah. Well, so this is pretty much, you think that's where you'll stay?
I think that we'll have to for quite a while. I've got six kids myself. I came from six and I had six. My oldest is 14 and my youngest is just 5 months. So we'll be here for quite a while.
Now, well, of course, the natural question is, how on earth do you find time to write with six children?
How do I find time to write? I don't mind writing with the kids around, actually. My computer is in the living room where they have their television and their PlayStation, and I don't know, my brain, I can multitask, I guess. And so I do write while they're doing their things. And sometimes I write after they go to sleep. Wherever I find time, I write. And I do a lot of composing in my head. And so by the time I actually do have a couple of minutes to sit down at the computer, I have a lot of the story already worked out and kind of have it how I want it to sound, so I don't have to go back and do a lot of editing and deleting. So I'm lucky that way. Also, my husband and I, we just surround ourselves with really motivated and productive people, and so our life doesn't look busier than anyone else's. So we don't feel sorry for ourselves. We just get to work.
Well, so just to go back to sort of writing the mechanics, this novel, The Turtle Catcher, I think is fairly complex with multiple voices and points of view throughout, and a lot of flashbacks and telling of stories that are backstories to things that happened earlier in the novel. When you were writing this, did you have to map it out and kind of write all of that down as an outline for yourself, or did you write this and then go back and rearrange and arrange?
I didn't. I write it how it comes out. And then later on, my husband, who's a really good editor and really should be working in New York somewhere at a major publishing house, sort of fixed it for me so that it could read literally in some way, because I tend to be scattered, as you can probably hear through my telephone conversation. I think in anecdotes, and I relate things thematically or symbolically more than chronologically. And while I'm writing, I don't think about it at all. I don't care if it if one event doesn't follow its other linear event. It doesn't bother me at all to write them out of order. So he helps me with that when I have it all finished. And I also don't think it's necessary to have a plot that's, you know, standard. Here's the introduction of characters, here's the rising action, here's the climax, here's the resolution. I actually sort of find that boring. I spent quite a lot of time reading Eastern European literature while I was writing The Turtle Catcher, and those guys write whatever they want, whenever they want. So I just sort of freed myself up from the, I don't know, from the expectations of writing linearly and decided it wasn't necessary.
Oh, no, judging from, for me anyway, and the effect of this book, or the effect this book had on me, I certainly don't care about linearity either. And, you know, I thought the book worked really well. I didn't have any well, if I think about it, I kind of absorbed the book in one pretty intense read. You know, the book, I think one of the things that I think of, this I learned this in probably years ago in a writing class, that, you know, the first page really matters. You've got to, you know, hook your reader right away, and you did. And, you know, once I started, I was pretty much committed to this novel, you know, all the way through. So, you know, just as a reader, I think it was very effective to have the multiple points of view, and the non-linearity of the story really worked, because ultimately it was about a kind of spiritual story rather than necessarily the literal events, although you got a lot of events into the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of things that happened, and they relate. And I think, you know, it works as a novel. And I have to agree with you that lack of linearity doesn't matter.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
So now you wrote, I mean, this book is obviously not brand new. I read it in paperback. It's out this year as a paperback. You published it in 2009 in hardcover. You probably wrote it a few years before that.
Right.
So have you been continuing to write fiction? Are you writing memoir now again, or what are you doing?
Well, right now I've got two projects in the hopper. I have one at my agent. It's a young adult book that I co-wrote with my husband called Horse Camp. And that one is just about ready for being sent out to some publishing houses. And then the other I'm working on is an adult fiction called Stillwater, cleverly set in Stillwater, Minnesota, at the onset of statehood. And it's about a pair of twins who are separated at birth. And, oh, I don't know where they're all taking me quite yet. I got about 180 pages that are pretty good, but I have to figure out how they're all related. And then my next project, which I'm already thinking about, is going to be a collection of personal essays. But I'm forcing myself to wait on those until I get these two fiction pieces out the door, so that I don't get too schizophrenic.
Yeah, it's probably wise to not
be
at once. Now, Stillwater, though, is east of the Twin Cities.
So right.
On the border with Wisconsin, so pretty far from where you are now.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, and I guess statehood for Minnesota was in the 1850s?
1858, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's that period of really early early pioneer era.
Right. Yep. I'm doing some work with a fur trapper. I've got a couple of timber barons and their wives, and it's just going crazy right now. And a missionary. I've got a missionary running around saving prostitutes.
Probably, there were probably a lot of missionaries around that time.
Wouldn't
be surprising. And fur traders and lots of Indians and people coming in through there from all over the place.
Yeah, it was a fun time.
Yeah, also difficult. I try, you know, sometimes try to imagine what it was like in Minnesota and Wisconsin, you know, in the 1840s and 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever read a novel called Caddy Woodlawn?
No, I haven't.
It's a young adult that I discovered years ago. When, you know, I have my oldest daughter was in her early teens. I had this idea that it would be really good for her to read books about women settlers and, you know, women on the prairie. So I asked a bookseller who runs a women's bookstore in Madison, Wisconsin, to send me a reading list.
And okay.
She sent me this great list of novels where women were the main characters or were the prime movers. And Caddy Woodlawn takes place in Wisconsin in 1867, when Caddy is 12 years old.
Okay.
And it was written by a woman in the 1930s, if I'm remembering this right. So it was about her, you know, kind of fictionalized version of her own childhood. Anyway, it's a great novel.
I'll check it out.
Yeah, no, it's worth reading. And it's still in print, you know, after all these years. But what's great is, you know, the setting of Minnesota and Wisconsin in, you know, that kind of period, there's just... it's just so different. It's hard to describe. I mean, you know, in your novel, in The Turtle Catcher, it's early 20th century, and the roots of those people's experiences are obviously very different from ours. They're in the 19th century. But we can still recognize the 20th century in your book. And, you know, it's much closer to us than the period now you're talking about for your next book.
Right, yeah, yep.
It should be interesting. Well, I really love your writing. I'm a big fan now of the not only the story, but it's really the quality of the writing, which I think is tremendous. So I will look forward to reading future books.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thanks. And thanks for talking to me today. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Nicole Helgett, who's the author of a novel, which I obviously love, called The Turtle Catcher. Thanks so much.
Thank you.